to this week's edition of World Crisis Radio. This is in Washington, D.C., and here we are on the afternoon of February 12th, 2016. And we are looking at the U.S. presidential campaign. We're heavy on domestic again this week, but we've got to talk about Syria, and we've got to talk about the world derivatives situation, since we know exactly what needs to be done about it. Let's take a minute and review the very revealing Democratic Party debate, which occurred last night between Bernie Sanders and Mrs. Clinton. And let's see what we can learn about this. Remember, our goal, the destruction of the Republican Party as a national force, the only serious goal, which, of course, Bernie is too Lilliputian in his thinking, too surrounded by bankrupt Beltway bandits, the Tad Devine set, to know what is actually happening vis-a-vis the Republicans. The answer to how you get your programs through the Congress is, why, Judy? By destroying the Republican Party, sweeping aside the shards and proceeding on the path of modernization and civilization, eschewing the barbarism and savagery of recent years here in the United States. Now, we got to talk about many aspects of this. It was a debate in Wisconsin last night, right, the homeland of Scott Walker. This is a place where the Republican Party has really proven what an albatross it was around, is around the neck of any idea of serious change. You remember that the people went out there and got the signatures to recall the fascist governor Scott Walker, failed presidential candidate now in the meantime. But, of course, after that, there had to be an election to replace him, and the Democratic Party came in with one of their sorry thugs and hacks who wouldn't even talk about trade union rights, wouldn't attack Walker effectively, and therefore lost. So all of the work of the people turned into bitter gall when it was poured into the bottles of the Democratic Party. So this has to be borne in mind. Now, of course, in this Wisconsin debate, we are coming off the New Hampshire primary, and we should pause to think about the New Hampshire primary. This was an historical turning point. The Clinton vote fraud machine, deeply rooted in New Hampshire. If you go back to 8 years ago on Tarpley.net, you'll find an article that I did about the collision of the two vote fraud machines in the New Hampshire primary in 2008. On the one hand, you had the Obama Zbigniew Brzezinski Trilateral Commission color revolution style attempt to steal an election, take an election. And on the other hand, the Hillary Clinton more traditional, older, union-based, party hack-based kind of vote fraud machine. And it was in the vector sum of those two that you got the result, which was that at that point Hillary's vote fraud machine was stronger. This time, Hillary vote fraud machine, Clintonista vote fraud machine, not looking too good in New Hampshire. So Bernie won New Hampshire by 22 points. Now, that is a very important result. It shows that in that future faction fight that I'm trying to orchestrate, if I can, after the collapse of the reactionary and indeed fascist, racist, xenophobic, bigoted, and generally barbarous and savage Republicans. After the Republicans are gone, the Democrats obviously split because there are two parties, as you see. Hillary Clinton tries to muddy the waters. She says, Bernie and I agree about the goals. That's your cue, Bernie. No, we don't. No, we don't. That's a lie. That's a lie. But, of course, feckless Bernie, he has been an independent for all these decades, and he has all the bad habits of an independent. He doesn't want to fight. He thinks that independents don't like acrimony. They'd rather have World War III or genocide or mass starvation. Anything is better in the eyes of one of these independents than to actually get down to a serious slugfest debate on issues. No, 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 no. That reminds them of what mommy and daddy were fighting about around the family table 30 or 40 years ago, right? And you can see how the trauma of youth then shape the neurotic and worse adults. But still, congratulations to Bernie on defeating that Clinton machine. That's an important turning point. Maybe we'll be rid of these people, right? When you think what Clinton brought, the abolition of welfare as we knew it. He didn't need to do it, but he did it anyway. His surrender to Greenspan and the Federal Reserve in the first term threw out what he had promised the American people because Greenspan told them it couldn't be afforded. And then we had the legalization of interstate banking, the removal of the Glass-Steagall, and above all, 2000, the Commodity Exchange Modernization Act, with the total deregulation of derivatives. And from that deed in 2000 to Lehman Brothers is 8 years of cancerous, metastatic growth of poisonous, kited, bankrupt derivatives. That's what Clinton gave us. And, of course, this guy is now an old roué, right? He is a Dorian Gray, except it's not the picture that's aging. It's this poor guy. Why doesn't he go home? Why doesn't he head for a nice vacation retreat and leave us alone, right? Why do we have to have these people? She, of course, is a dud. She is a very, very limited person. And then there's this machine. But, of course, she's the vehicle for all sorts of forces in Wall Street. Surprise! She's just like Trump on the other side. These are no outsiders. We'll talk about that in just a minute. So anyway, 22 points. On the Republican side, of course, the fascist Trump finally gets through, followed by the stealth scab, the stealth strikebreaker, himself a banker from Lehman Brothers, John Kasich. John Kasich is from Lehman Brothers. He was on the board when Lehman Brothers blew up the world with their stinking derivatives, and now he's a wonderful champion of Christian charity and moderation and so forth. Okay. So we'll get to Trump later. We'll get you later, Don. So now we have to look at what we had in this interesting debate last night. Now, if you looked at this debate, you would have assumed that Mrs. Clinton had been the winner in New Hampshire by 22 points and that poor Bernie had been the loser, even though he was coming off a 22-point win. Where was the momentum? Where was the upbeat, optimistic sense of the attack? Go in there and tear her to pieces. She's weak. She's a hypocrite. She's hated. She's a liar. Oh, no, we can't do that. He's still got these New England independents in his mind. And, of course, he's now in Wisconsin, which is rough enough, and he's projecting into South Carolina, right, the land of Lee Atwater, where the best thing to do is to accuse your opponent of having gotten electroshock through a car battery. That's the speed of Lee Atwater, R.I.P., his demise was one of the things that told the George H.W. Bush machine that maybe he wouldn't do so well in 1992. It was an omen for them. So Hillary's tactics of yesterday were essentially to muster her impudence, her sense of entitlement, her arrogance, and to project that. Now, here's what she's learned. In the last debate, we saw that Hillary was going on the attack quite a bit, and she actually got herself booed, right? So what Hillary has learned is this. Bernie normally will not attack. He is passive. He is timid. He doesn't understand the principle of the tactical offense. He has no killer instinct. And we'll be back in a minute on World Crisis Radio. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. Webster Tarpley, Washington, D.C., the 12th of February, 2016. So, Hillary has seen Bernie fundamentally weak, fundamentally passive, does a wonderful job in reeling off some of these numbers on certain themes. What she learned last time is that if she attacks him and really goes after him, he will strike back. And that was very punishing for her. So what she decided to do is not to attack, essentially to hang back and to snipe at him with snide remarks and, above all, lies. Lies, deception, prevarication, mendacity, manipulation, cheap tricks, debaters' points, all this stuff, essentially verbal constructs that mean nothing in the life of the average person. And at that point, she can see that he won't attack her. He's afraid to launch what might look like an attack. We saw that he can counterattack. Bernie can counterattack under certain circumstances, but he's got to be driven to the brink, right? That stuff about the artful smear, right? That got his goat. Then he wanted to attack. But even there, it's always very weak, very muted, very inadequate. So this time her tactic was, don't really attack Bernie strongly. Snipe at him, try to get his goat, keep him off balance, keep him flustered, keep him angry. Because the guy's a curmudgeon, right? He's always struggling not to lose his temper, is the way I see it. Because he doesn't want to do that, because he's an independent. He wants those fussy independent votes. They don't like conflict. But then in the last minutes, that's when she attacks. A sneak attack in the last minute saying, you know, you really hate Clinton. You really hate Obama, don't you, Bernie? You're against President Obama. How dare you? He's a paragon. The acme of this stuff was Hillary actually got to the point of trying to canonize the tactic of taking money from Wall Street. In other words, the fact that Obama took more money from Wall Street, in her mind, or her rhetoric at least, shows that it's perfectly okay to take all the money you want from Wall Street. So the whole campaign finance issue disappears for Hillary's rhetoric because Obama is up to his neck in this stuff. And therefore, how dare you criticize our wonderful paragon, Obama? Of course, there is such an issue, right? I don't think it's what it's cracked up to be, but it's a real issue and an important issue. And he ought to be using that to beat her over the head. And he's not. So, where does this come from? The tactic of lying. Well, lying is as old as time immemorial. But in particular, as a campaign strategy, I am thinking of Bill Bradley, former senator from New Jersey, versus Al Gore, vice president, Clintonista, part of the Clinton machine, at least up to a point, in the year 2000. And the way this worked was, Bradley had a very innovative, for the time anyway, it was a step forward towards raising the issue of health care. Bradley had a kind of health care plan, and Gore attacked it, and the way that Gore attacked it was by lying about it, distorting it, prevaricating, setting up straw men, and so forth. And at that point, Bradley had a choice. Either you say, stop lying, you're a liar, stop lying, or, is what Bradley actually did, since you're a timid, appealing to these independents, therefore, you do nothing and you lose. And that's what Bradley did. So he was out of the picture. Whatever he would have represented, it was, hopeless. So, the idea that fighting offends the fussy independents, I think, is one of the main tragic features here. Now, we're hearing more and more about how the party hacks of the Democratic Party, known as the superdelegates, are going to rally around Hillary. If you listen to the Diane Rehm show on National Public Radio this morning, you will hear that two snooty British and a couple of others, they're all rallying around Hillary because Bernie is pushing happy dust, right? Bernie is offering dreams and singing tomorrows and unicorns. But, of course, Hillary is the gritty reality. This is absolutely ridiculous. Hillary talks like a Republican. She denigrates the ability of government to solve problems. She talks like a Republican, and that's bad. That's real bad. She should pay a terrible price in the Democratic primary. And indeed, her idea is that somehow she's going to dupe the black community of South Carolina. Again, I can't imagine how this happens because you're in the black community in South Carolina. The last time you saw her was that she was playing the race card against Obama. Did you forget that? And now in the meantime, she poses as Obama's great friend. We'll get to that too in a minute. But Hillary obviously is not going to lift a finger for the black community. Not in a million years. She's the senator from Goldman Sachs. She's the senator from Wall Street. Are we crazy? So the idea would be then that lots of young black voters and young female black voters may indeed begin to see through this Haradan routine that Hillary does. Now, let's get into a couple of things here. Bernie Sanders, as we know, is what he says he is, a democratic socialist, which means a social democrat on the European scale, which is basically center, you know, and maybe 1 or 2 degrees to the left. But in many places, you know, like, I don't know, Portugal, the social democrats are real bad news reactionaries, right? Because these were the anti-communist red-baiting forces, anti-labor and all that. So Bernie comes from YPSL, Young People's Socialist League, and that was an anti-Soviet red-baiting group of, again, practically indistinguishable from the Young Republicans and the College Republicans. Now, concerning the Obama issue, we must, at this point, defend Bernie. Obama has been a tremendous disappointment in the sense that he, like Franklin D. Roosevelt, took office, in his case, January 2009, at the height of this crisis with 800,000 jobs per month going down the tubes. It's simply unbelievable. Obama wasted this opportunity. And I said so the same night at this meeting in Arlington, Virginia. I think it's up on tarpley.net. That you compare Obama's first inaugural to Franklin D. Roosevelt's first inaugural. Franklin D. Roosevelt says, the money changers have left their high seats in the temple. They have failed. They have failed, the money men. Obama, it's we have failed. No, we didn't fail, Obama. And we'll be back in a minute on World Crisis Radio. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. Webster Tarpley in Washington, D.C. All right. So is Bernie disappointed with Obama? Anybody would be. Anybody in their right mind would be disappointed with Obama. And, of course, I wrote not one but two books warning what a tragic thing this would be. One, during the primaries, right before the Pennsylvania primary of 2008. And then another one came out in August in time for the Democratic convention. Find somebody else, not this guy. He's all kinds of problems, right? He's strong where he should be weak and weak where he should be strong. This was a tremendous opportunity, right? You don't want to waste a crisis. Well, the 2008-2009 crisis was thoroughly wasted with Obama. And again, his first inaugural was this pathetic thing about how we have failed. That was, once you heard that, you might have surmised that not one Wall Street zombie banker, hedge fund hyena, or other swine would go to jail, as we see that they have not. If we have failed, then we can't scapegoat these wonderful zombie bankers and hedge fund hyenas in Wall Street. So remember also a meeting at the White House where Obama received the leaders, right, the blank fines and the Pandit, the bandits, and the rest of them, right, of the principal money center banks. And he said to them, gentlemen, the only thing standing between you and the pitchforks is me, Obama. Bad, bad, bad. And that's what he did. He shielded the zombie bankers from the righteous indignation of the pitchforks. Not one went to jail, and so forth and so on down the line. Hillary keeps talking about Dodd-Frank. Dodd-Frank is a mockery. Dodd-Frank is a tissue of fakery. It has had precious little effect. The financial oversight, the Consumer Protection Agency, will make sure that when you lose your home, the mortgage will be printed in large type and in plain English, so you'll know exactly why they think they can throw you out of your house. Awful, awful. So she is a complete faker. I'm sorry. Hillary Clinton certainly is, and Obama always has been on this, right? How did we get the Satan sandwich? How did we get the sequester? The problem with Obama is not that he didn't seek bipartisan agreement. He fell all over himself. He was negotiating with himself. He was making preventive concession after preventive concession on this front of, above all, killer austerity. Remember the chained consumer price index that he tried to foist on us and may still? We'll see in a minute. But the whole issue with Obama, Obama is no paragon. Indeed, buyer's remorse, to be sure. Buyer's remorse, a go-go, lots of it. Buyer's remorse would include, as this guy Bill Press says, although he's a former head of the Democratic Party of California, my God. This Bill Press says it's because no bankers went to jail and because there was no public option. I would add in the terrible destructive effects of the Satan sandwich, the sequester, and remember the fiscal cliff and all the rest of this stuff. With Obama always on the defensive, never able to put up a fighting front, and indeed offering concessions well into his second term. And what are you going to do, blame Obama because Mitch McConnell had a blood vendetta? And he said, my main job in life is to destroy this president. What could Obama do at that point? Well, he could, as I've said before, Obama could have made sure that Mitch McConnell's wife never got any invitations to anything. No state dinners, no nothing. In other words, frozen out of the scene. And Mitch McConnell every night would have been heard that yammering, complaining, whining, nagging wife. Why can't we go anywhere? So, that's how he could have done it, but that's not Obama, right? No drama, Obama. I'm sorry. And all this bipartisan stuff. The bipartisan stuff is an illusion where Obama preens and struts as bipartisan at the expense of the people who put Obama where he was. And that same thing goes for Bernie Sanders. Don't be civil, Bernie. Be a fighter. Because otherwise you're sacrificing your supporters who sweat blood and money for you. And you're doing it so that you can essentially posture on the stage that you're bipartisan. It is of no good use. Now, let's talk about distancing. Now, here we have an article, interesting article, October 8th, 2015, ABC News. Liz Kreutz, okay, ABC News. What are the points where Hillary had separated herself from Obama? You know, with the, you know, and showing it off, right? She was anxious to show that she was distancing from Obama. So this was the situation in the first week of October of 2015. Okay, on immigration, Hillary says Obama is too harsh, too many raids separating families. I guess she might be right on that one, okay? But she's certainly separating from the paragon Obama. On climate change, Hillary says no Keystone Pipeline and no Arctic drilling. So she's separating from Obama and us. I'm not interested in the merits of these issues right now. I'm simply trying to say, Bernie, if you had a real campaign manager instead of that pathetic loser, Tad Devine, then you'd be able to have several of these to throw back in her face. And I'll tell you the one that's most important. On health care, Mrs. Clinton said, we're going to build on Obamacare. This is about the same that Bernie says. And repeal the Cadillac tax, right? In other words, don't tax the most comprehensive health plans. Whatever it is, whichever side you want to be on, that's a divergence. Is the economy stalled? She said, yes. And of course, Obama, White House says no. On trade, Hillary is supposedly against the Trans-Pacific Partnership that just got signed last week. Now, we know that's a lie, right? She's going to be for free trade. But in the election, she's different from Obama. The most important one, the one that I would pound on, is she's for a no-fly zone over Syria, including, this was made after the Russians came in, including against the Russians. World War III, conflict we don't need. So, Tad, Bernie, get a hold of this issue that she's, Hillary's for the no-fly zone in Syria, and you're not, because you want world peace. Then there's what they call in this article style. Style is that, of course, Obama won't fight, right? Obama is a weakling. We have this quote from President Sarkozy, the first time he met Obama in the summer of 2008, I guess it was. And the comment from Sarkozy was, est-il faible? Is he a weakling? Well, yeah, to a significant degree. On the other hand, he's the weakling that we needed in the last 2 years so that there's no-fly zone. In other words, we are aware of the fact that Obama in today's world is in many cases the lesser evil, especially compared to Hillary Clinton. So all of those issues, and most especially the no-fly zone in Syria, would be ways for Bernie to fight back if he didn't have this slouch of a Tad Devine, right, whose basic, his resume is Dukakis and Kerry and Gore and all these other exquisite failures. All right, now, MSNBC, that this is the year of the outsider, that is ridiculous. Donald Trump is not an outsider. Donald Trump is an insider. Donald Trump is not anti-establishment. He is the establishment. He is a face mask for the Wall Street zombie banks over decades to facilitate operations of real estate speculation. And he provides the theatrics, the atmospherics. He can represent this in public and generally help the speculative parasitical process along, like bidding up Manhattan rents to now see. We'll be back in a minute with more good advice for Bernie Sanders, including fire Tad Devine. Fire Tad Devine. Back in a minute. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio, February 12th, 2016. Now, Donald Trump is not an outsider. Donald Trump is a fascist, and the art of being a fascist, as we've been studying for several weeks, right, with Daniel Guérin and others, right, with Neumann and Ignazio Silone and Wolfgang Abendroth and the whole literature of fascist history, primarily in Europe, but not only. Donald Trump is a fascist. He's not an outsider. Of course, to be an effective fascist, you have to pose as an outsider. But once again, he is the vehicle and manifestation of the New York Wall Street zombie banks. So how can he be an outsider? In terms of the hack clubs of the Democratic Party or the Republican Party in this case, yeah, maybe he's not exactly somebody who spent his time with them, but that's basically irrelevant. In other words, drop the methodological lenses of cultural populism. Forget that. He insults people in the imperialist finance bourgeoisie. Okay, so what? How about the institutions of the imperialist finance bourgeoisie? Those are the ones that I have to pay attention to. Trump is not laying a glove on any of those. So, this thesis of MSNBC amounts to covering up for fascism. And some of these people are now noting that when Trump first came out, he was called a fascist. When he went on the anti-Muslim exclusion jag towards the end of the year, right, November to December, he was called a fascist again. But now the force of the media is essentially helping him to come back. We're going to talk more about Trump in a minute. Okay, now here's the problem with Bernie. Bernie, you're pushing a process reform. You're pushing campaign finance reform. And that sounds plausible, and it should be done, but that's not the mass traction economic issue you need to lead with. If you want to convince the black voter in South Carolina to vote for you, you better have those New Deal programs, and you better have a way to pay for them. And here, with all modesty, we want to direct the attention of Bernie to the Tax Wall Street Party. Bernie, you say you want a tax on Wall Street transactions to pay for college for everybody. Let's get down to the numbers. Let's get to the nitty-gritty. Where's the beef? We remember that the candidacy of Jimmy Carter, 1976 and primarily then, he was accused of fuzziness. Well, Bernie, if Carter was fuzzy, you are a fuzzy-wuzzy. because you say, I want to break up the banks. Well, how is that going to work? How is it going to be done? Under what law? Yielding what? In other words, a bunch of smaller banks that still operate with derivatives and speculation and parasitism and all the rest of that? Are you going to nationalize them? Unfortunately, that sounds radical, but it's not. In Europe, there are lots of nationalized banks, and they're about as big pigs as the unnationalized ones. So this is not enough. We say restructure, the Tax Wall Street Party says, restructure the whole thing so that you're favoring tangible, physical, commodity production of actual products, tangible, physical, and less on the services, much less. Actually, you want to circulate the money through the productive sector, right, in infrastructure, manufacturing, farming, mining, scientific research, and so on down the line. And no money at all for speculation, right? No money at all. And right now it's everything for parasitical speculation and derivatives, and basically very little for the productive side, if anything. The other problem Bernie has is he never mentions the Federal Reserve. There is this thing, Bernie, called the Federal Reserve. They have all the money in the world. They have all the money in the world, and it's good that they do, because we want to use it. We want to use it to finance a recovery. We want 30 million new productive jobs. We want 10 million youth and entry-level jobs. Much of this is going to be financed by the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve will pay for the recovery. We will force them to do it. We will nationalize them piece by piece or with one fell swoop or whatever it takes, and that will be our 30 million new productive jobs in infrastructure and related issues, and the 10 million jobs for the inner cities to take care of the obvious emergency that we're dealing with there. Bernie, start talking about the Federal Reserve. Elizabeth Warren had the guts, at least a couple of years ago, for a brief season of a couple of months, to say, force the Federal Reserve to grant 0.75% credit through the discount window to essentially finance some student loans, right? And we would say to refinance everything. Refinance $1.5 trillion at 0%, freeze that, and we'll see what we do with it later. But in the meantime, it might as well just sit there with no interest accruing. We'll be happy to do that as a way to invest in American youth, right? The millennials have to get a break somewhere. So look, Bernie, less with the process reform, okay? You cannot make campaign finance reform the main issue. If you want to attack billionaires, you've got to propose to get your hand in their pocket and rip out some of those ill-gotten gains. And the voting reform won't do it. Why is it they have so much money in the first place? Why aren't we taxing away some of that money? If there are $2 trillion stashed overseas, let's have a tax bill that says you bring it back next year or half of it is going to be taken out of your assets in the U.S. And, of course, an emergency executive order to stop the absconding of companies to foreign shores. No, we're going to seize you. We're going to get you under the Defense Production Act, right? We're at war. We're still under multiple 9/11 emergencies. We could say, hey, you're not going to move that plant to Mexico because we're going to hit you with the Defense Production Act. How about them apples? Now, what else do we have? Remember, Dukakis said the race is about competence, not ideology. I'll tell you my story with Dukakis. It's quite interesting, quite central to the campaign another time. But competence, not ideology. That's what Hillary Clinton is saying right now. Hillary Clinton is the new Dukakis. Bernie is the new Carter. He's fuzzy. She says it's competence, not ideology. Hillary will do nothing for the black community. All right, now, here are some of the things that Tad Devine or somebody else should be putting into the briefing book. The emails, for God's sake. This is the suicide of Bernie. He could have won going away in Iowa. We want to know what's in the emails about Libya, about Egypt, about Tunisia, about Syria, about the airlift of terrorists from Benghazi to Turkey and then into Syria, right? All those jihadis that got to go on a free trip, thanks to you, the U.S. taxpayer, or maybe the Saudis at best. That's the thing with the emails. Now, on the same day as this debate yesterday, a federal subpoena was issued to the Bill, Hillary, and Chelsea Clinton Foundation for documents apparently having to do with conflicts of interest between the Clinton Foundation and Madame Clinton when she was Secretary of State. There's also a problem. Huma Abedin was working for four separate entities, the State Department, the Clinton Foundation, and a couple of consulting ventures. She was quadruple dipping. And of course, Huma Abedin is the liaison to the Muslim Brotherhood, which has been in an alliance with the CIA and before that with the British MI6 since its foundation. It was created by British intelligence. So the emails, the subpoena, my God, how can you let that go by? The Goldman Sachs speeches. Bernie never raised the issue. Bernie, you're a weakling. I'm really sorry. You want to put your head in your hands and weep when you see another golden opportunity. Obama squandered the opportunity. Bernie, what are you doing? You're squandering a golden opportunity. Then there's also Iowa vote fraud. He's let that go by. The no-fly zone. Her role in starting the Libyan war in the first place. Get the idea? We need a fighting candidate. Get rid of Ted Devine and put somebody else in. Back to the minute. Welcome to the second hour of World Crisis Radio. This is Webster Topley in Washington, D.C. Now, we have tried to show a path to greater success for Bernie Sanders. Get rid of those defeatist, incompetent so-called advisors, beltway parasites, and focus on some fighting. Right? You got to stop being an independent in New England because that's not where you are anymore. Got to have a sense of where you are. So that's for Bernie. Now let's look at the Republicans. Now the point about this is the media, the corrupt, corporate, controlled media. The media, sous influence, as the French say. Those guys have built up Trump. There's no other way to put it. They have made Trump. And let's just look. If you could have listened to all of this coverage, you never would have known certain fundamental facts. Now, remember, New Hampshire is this place where you can register as a Republican or a Democrat. And that's, I guess it's about 25 or so percent in each group there. And then there's this thing in the middle where you register as an independent or undeclared. Okay? You're not telling what party you're in. And the ones in the middle can vote on either side. They can vote with the Republicans if they think that's interesting or with the Democrats. All right? So I would say that, in an average year, certainly the Republicans and the Democrats, they sort of alternate. Here, let's look at 1996. 1996 New Hampshire primary, there were about 100,000 votes, 90,000 votes on the Democratic side, and 208,000 on the Republican side. And that simply shows you that this is not a state where the registrations are lopsidedly pro-anything. It goes back and forth. And here's how it went this time. Bernie Sanders got more votes than any other candidate on Tuesday night. He got about 150,000 votes. Donald Trump came in a distant second. Bernie, 150,000. Trump, 100,000. So Bernie got 50,000 votes more than Trump. Did they tell you that? Did they tell you how weak this fascist is? This is like the London Times propping up Hitler on the eve of the March into the Rhineland or the Anschluss or whatever it is. In other words, the essence of pro-fascist propaganda is, and this was true in the United States, right? The Hearst Press, Hearst, and the Chicago Tribune, in other words, the McCormick, Cyrus McCormick and the rest of these people, and they owned the New York Daily News, I guess it was, and other, and there was a paper here in Washington also. Sissy, his niece Sissy was the head of this thing. So The technique of pro-fascist propaganda is not so much to say fascism is good, it's to say they're so powerful, you can't oppose them, you better capitulate and get whatever you can. Okay? So again, Bernie, 150,000, Trump, 100,000, and then poor Hillary, in defeat, got almost as much as Trump. Trump got 100,000, Hillary got about 96,000. How about that? Look at that weakness. The guy's a loser. It's a fraud. You've been brainwashed. Break out of it. Trump, according to the recent polls, is now one-third of one-third. And I've been saying this for months. And I've seen a couple of people on cable TV now joining in. So Bernie represents one-ninth of one-half. In other words, one-ninth of the half of the population or so that even bother to register and vote. So that means Trump represents at most, now this is even giving him advantages, at most about 10 or 11%, okay? Now, let's go back to Ross Perot, right? Don't tell me there's never been anything like Trump. How tiresome. Only the radically anti-historical consciousness of a dupe could believe that. Ross Perot, when Ross Perot came out, the response was electric. Hey, we're going into debt, and that's just sad. I kid you not. My risk my case. So here comes Ross Perot, right? It's interesting southern populist rural figure, spouting the ideas of Peter Peterson and the Concord Coalition, or what we call that today, the austerity ghouls, right? This obsession with the public debt was planted in the American psyche by little Ross Perot. Now, at one point, Ross Perot was leading both Bush the Elder, George H.W. Bush, and Clinton. Ross Perot was in first place among all the three candidates who were going to take part in the November 1992 election. Okay? Has Trump come anywhere near Ross Perot? Not in a million years. Have the media been reminding you? Put this in perspective. Context, experience, reliability. Well, we have that here. They don't. So, Perot was, again, he was leading. We'll track down the exact numbers for your edification. When it came to the election, and this, of course, was after having dropped out, you may remember the famous Opera Man skit on Saturday Night Live when, Pero es candidato, and poi, pero non è candidato, and then some obscenities. You ought to look that one up, right? Opera Man, Adam Sandler. One of the better things he did. Most things after that, nowhere near as good. So, that's Perot. In the election, though, Perot had dropped out, come back in, and he still got 20% of the whole electorate. Now, that's twice as much as what Trump has right now. Trump, of course, thrives in the free media, the obsession of the media. MSNBC now is putting on 10, 15, 20 minutes of unrefuted, uncriticized, raw demagogy from Trump. What a shame. Has Jeffrey Immelt made a deal with Trump? Who's buying whom? There are a lot of people getting bought and sold. And when they get bought and sold, that's not good. So, how about this? Pat Buchanan, 1996. Pat Buchanan, 1996, won the New Hampshire primary. He beat Bob Dole by 3%. So Buchanan came in with 27% of the vote. So what did Trump get? 33, 34, couple of points more. No big deal. Buchanan was pushing very similar things, right? Demagogy, middle America, xenophobia, racism, and the rest of this stuff. But at that point, the ruling class didn't need him or didn't want him. Right now, the ruling class is desperate. Get scapegoats. If nothing is done, the Wall Street zombie bankers and hedge fund hyenas are going to pay the price. With Trump, it becomes Mexico, Japan, China, the Latinos, the great deportation story, and the Muslims and the other groups that he wants to scapegoat. The fundamental fascist mechanism of the scapegoating. So, let's see. Trump has said now this past week in an interview with Bill O'Reilly, Trump does not want due process for the 12 million, what he calls illegals, new Americans in my book. If you want to come here and work, you got to be welcome. That's our ace in the hole. That's the biggest strategic asset we have. How many people want to go to these other countries, Japan, China, Russia, Europe? Some want to go to Europe, but most of all, it's here. That's the greatest advantage the United States has ever had, built up over centuries and indeed, in many ways, obsolete, but nevertheless can be revivified. It can be refilled with the meaning that it lost. So here we are, World Crisis Radio, back in a minute. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio, Webster Tarpley in Washington, D.C. Keep up with everything on World Crisis Radio. I believe there's a Republican debate this weekend. We are generally live blogging these things, and then you get that incisive criticism in real time. You don't have to listen to the actual debate. Just check up on the live tweet, and you will know what actually happened, as the historians usually say, right? Leopold von Ranke, what actually happened, wie es eigentlich gewesen ist. That's our goal. Now, Trump says if you're an illegal, you will be deported with no due process. Can you imagine what this means? Hold on to your hats, because that's going to be you soon enough. Okay? So this is bad news. He's essentially throwing overboard the U.S. Constitution. And once he starts doing that in the campaign, there's no limit. Now, of course, the argument, he says, no due process. This is with O'Reilly. No due process if they're here illegally. Yeah. The court hearing, a court hearing with a federal judge and an attorney, as well as a prosecutor, but your attorney, you can produce evidence. You have compulsory service. You can force people to show up and testify. That's how you find out if somebody is an illegal. Now, I'm not interested. I don't want to go anywhere near this far. But once due process has been shredded for any group of persons under United States jurisdiction, then you are losing this entire question of the Constitution. It's very easy to see. Trump is full of contempt for the Constitution. The so-called libertarians and other hypocrites and fakers and scoundrels who have been talking about their love for the Constitution have now flipped over to support Trump. It shows they don't give a damn about the U.S. Constitution. They believe that might makes right. They don't care about this. So if you do it to one group, it'll be done to other groups, and sooner or later, it will be done to you. And anybody attempting, as I've always said, anybody attempting to deport 12 million undocumented foreign workers will create a police state. And there's exactly what you see. Trump is proposing a police state. He hates the Constitution. He hates the Congress. He never talks about Congress. This is non-existent. All these pedants and hacks on the story on this, you know, is Bernie realistic and so forth. How about Trump? How about deporting the 12 million? Can that be done with the Congress? I think it has to be done over the heads of Congress. So you're getting to a point where you're going to have rule by decree. So you better watch out and make sure it's a good decree rather than a bad decree. Obama's decree on immigration is basically okay. It's much better than the decrees that might be coming from fascists or reactionaries. Now, console yourself also, because no matter what Trump is doing, this is now rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic, okay? This is the pecking order and the hierarchy on the Titanic. Every Republican debate spews more hate, more venom, against the Latinos, against blacks, against Muslims, against women, against young people, against Asians, and on and on and on. He is digging the grave of the Republican Party. The grave digger, the wrecking ball, and the Samson, pushing down the temple of the Philistines. And man, are those Republicans, are they ever Philistines? He is dealing, as one commentator put it, he's not dealing in dog whistles. He's not dealing in racism as an innuendo. He's dealing with racism as a train whistle, right? As the foghorn on a tugboat. You can't miss it. Now, another fallacy here. Steve Schmidt, former advisor to McCain, right? I think he's employed on MSNBC, CNN, one of these. He's starting to call Trump a nationalist. Well, nationalist is what Trump is not. Not in this country, anyway. Find yourself a country based on ethnic origins and clans and maybe tribes. That would be the best. A tribal country, hard to find. There are some. That's where Trump should go. Because if you say, I'm going to have a country and these Latinos, 12 million people are going to be deported, that I hate Latinos, I hate Muslims, I hate all these other people. That's what's coming out of Trump's mouth. He is destroying the notion of American nationality. And that is the one that we have to say the melting pot. There is a melting pot. And it means that all of these different groups come, they bring their contributions, and this essentially is amalgamated and fused together to create a new world outlook and something that goes beyond a mere ethnic nationality. I don't want to have an ethnic nationality. The first time anybody asked me my ethnic nationality was when I was applying for a visa to go to the Soviet Union in 1967 to see the May Day parade. What's your ethnic nationality? And it's really not in our system, right? This is alien to our system. Now, of course, even the U.S. federal government is asking for this all the time. That is, of course, a divide and conquer strategy developed in the foundations. But if you say that there's white America, and then there's this, you know, it's almost like Theodore Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson, right? They talked about the hyphenated Americans, right? The Italian Americans, Irish Americans, German Americans, and then there were the real Americans on the other side. This is alien to the system. This destroys us. This throws away for no gain and only loss our most important trump card in this entire situation. So this is, of course, also the Pat Buchanan, Sam Francis theory of Middle America. Middle America. Well, of course, with Trump, it's Middle Europa, isn't it? Middle Europa, that the Trump family from Germany, the first wife from the Czech Republic, the second wife now from Slovenia. He's got relatives in Poland. This is far too narrow. I mean, there's all kinds of nice places there. Sure, I'd be glad to go. But this is narrow. The U.S. has to be inclusive. It has to be worldwide. The notion of democratic universalism, right? It is an idea. Anyone can support the idea. If you support the idea, you're going to be welcome to make these contributions. Abraham Lincoln, 1864. We're going to get to him right now. Back in a minute. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. So we got to wrap up on these domestic themes. Trump is an anti-nationalist. He wishes to destroy the evolving notion of American nationality, which once again is based on agreement with a philosophical idea embodied in the Constitution and, I would add, in the American system of political economy. Bernie, if you want to be smart, you ought to stop saying this stupid democratic socialism, social democracy. This is absurd and obsolete. The social democrats have been red baiters, union busters, austerity ghouls. What they did in Germany after World War One was filthy and horrendous, right? The bloodhound Noska who tracked down everybody and killed them. They worked with those Freikorps, perpetuated monarchy. If they could, they would have, but they couldn't. People wouldn't let them. So why don't you call yourself the American system? Why don't you talk about Henry Clay, Abraham Lincoln? Bernie, why don't you talk more about Franklin D. Roosevelt? Stop with the Winston Churchill. Winston Churchill hated the United States. He's the butcher of Gallipoli. He's the guy with the golden pound that set the stage for the crash of 1929. He's the one who said, I'll drag the Americans in. And my approach is that Winston S. Churchill had broken the Japanese naval code, JN-25-5 number code, and he knew that the Pearl Harbor attack was coming, and he's the one who withheld the information from Franklin D. Roosevelt so that he could get the U.S. into the war and with maximum losses. So we'll talk about that. The strong man, the man on horseback, Trump, this is a hollow, hollow construct. He's nowhere near as strong as the media make you think. But that is how Hitler was manufactured, right? Hitler was constructed, socially constructed, by the media and others as this figure. So, Abraham Lincoln. Abraham Lincoln was interested in a larger population for the United States. And we have the Republican platform of 1864 calls for the continued benefits of immigration into the United States, especially from Europe. So that was 1864. And in 1864, Abraham Lincoln himself says, we have to rejoice that despite the horrible sacrifices of the Civil War, our population is growing implicitly, despite this, you know, the terrible losses. So we have to be glad that immigration is making up the difference. So I'll go with Abraham Lincoln any day against these vermin like Trump or his predecessor Buchanan and Sam Francis and these other middle Americans with their train whistles. We have an article here in the Washington Post today, Friday, February 12th, Michael Gerson, the alpha male ascends. So Trump is the alpha male? I'll tell you what Trump is. He's an epsilon minus semi-moron. That's him. Go back to Jamaica Estates, you epsilon minus semi-moron. This interesting theme of the fascist Duce, right? The original Duce, Mussolini, was supposedly somebody who had these alpha male powers, and in particular, he could hypnotize groups of women. If you're a real expert, you want to become a real expert, you've got to read Carlo Emilio Gadda on the erotic or what can we say, this kind of psychological impact of the Duce specifically on women. That's not really a scholarly study. It's a kind of a novel, but highly interesting nonetheless. So those are some of these issues. Now, the Bundy gang has finally been rounded up, and it's damn well about time. We have to have a policy, a public policy, of zero tolerance for armed gangs. Nobody, but nobody, goes out there as an armed gang and seizes federal property, threatens federal officials, and other things. Because you can see, look at Libya. Chaos and anarchy are not that far away. Now, we are obviously much better off than Libya. We have stronger institutions. We have better economy and all this other stuff. But make no mistake, we are in a time of grave instability. I would say in the Middle East, right? You don't like Assad? I would say any functioning government is better than that congeries of 150 different terrorist groups that would like to take over and reproduce Libya. Same story in Libya. You don't like Gaddafi? I think Gaddafi had many, many positive features. You don't like him? Take a look at what it is today with hundreds and hundreds of killer groups, right? Terrorists, lunatics, fanatics. You're better off with a stable government. And that goes for us here. We don't want the Bundy gang. We don't want them coming in. Remember, the origin of the modern state, right, and it's starting up in Italy in 1310, the prototype at least, the Galeazzo, the Visconti dynasty in Milan is where this comes from. By studying Visconti, and in particular by studying Francesco Sforza during this time, Louis XI of France was able to create the first new monarchy or modern state, something looking like a modern state, where the monarchy allies with the bourgeoisie in the cities against the nobility. And the problem with the nobility is just what we see with these people. It's private armies waging private warfare and creating chaos and anarchy. And, of course, they're all totally wrapped up in their lunatic ideologies. Now, it is very important that Cloven Bundy, he of the cloven hoof, has also been arrested, because that monstrosity of April 2015 was otherwise hanging over our heads. And you cannot have crazed secessionists, libertarians, white supremacists with military style weapons pointing loaded weapons and sniper scopes at federal officials. That is simply intolerable. We can't have that. And I don't want to be driving down a road where a bunch of secessionists and Confederates and lunatics come out of the bushes in military fatigues with rifles and say, pull over to the side, papers please. I'll take my chances with the FBI, not with these characters in their fatigues, right? We're against the FBI, obviously, but the point is, you're better off fighting an oppressive government with peaceful political means than you are going along with these lunatics and fascists. The other thing that the press tends to cover up, these people are Mormons. This is, in effect, a Mormon insurrection. And I am very pleased with myself, quite frankly, that I wrote this book, Just Too Weird, Bishop Romney and the Mormon Takeover of America with Polygamy, Theocracy, and Subversion. 2012. This essentially it's required reading. You can't understand contemporary reality without it. The question of land titles, right? The Mormon theory of land titles was the United States government can say nothing about land titles. They come directly from God. And the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, 1848, giving the territory of Utah from Mexico to Washington, to the United States, doesn't affect the validity of the Mormon land titles that had been done by themselves, not by the Mexican government. The Mormons incited Indian wars. The Mormons hate the Americans. Brigham Young was a primitive communist, and on and on. Get this book, Just Too Weird, Tarpley.net. Back in a minute. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. Now, as I hope people are aware, the standpoint of this broadcast in World Affairs is, first of all, that there should be a condominium between the Russian Federation and the United States, a joint oversight of world affairs, a kind of chairmanship à deux inside the Security Council, between Moscow and Washington as a condominium to find solutions to the pressing problems and, when necessary, to impose them over the various squabbling petty states and, in particular, over the secret armies of Saudi Arabia and so forth, right, the terrorist forces. So we are happy to see a Russo-American agreement for a ceasefire, a cessation of hostilities in the civil war in Syria, starting apparently next week, but in any case by about March 1st. It means that there will be humanitarian deliveries to the various besieged cities, which is good, and that, however, this does not apply to attacks on the Islamic State, that is ISIS, ISIL, Daesh, IS, Not, they're going to be hit, and Jabhat al-Nusra, the Al-Qaeda affiliate, will also be hit. For the others, though, there's going to be a respite. Now, there are large gaps, okay? And we hope for the best. Now, the encouraging sign is Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, has described, now I'm quoting from the Washington Post of today, Lavrov described a qualitative change in U.S. military policy to cooperate with Russia in continuing the fight against the Islamic State. Until now, the Obama administration has declined to deal with Russia except to deconflict their airstrikes to prevent their aircraft from running into each other in serious skies. So air traffic controllers. Lavrov says, the key thing is to build direct contacts, not only on procedures to avoid incidents, but also on cooperation between our militaries. Yes, yes, yes. That's what we need. Now, the target, absolutely, in my opinion, and I submit this to both great powers, you, Russia, you, America, must close the Jarablus corridor. Anything else is opportunism. Anything else is dishonest. Anything else tends to be immoral, right, that you're angling for some unilateral advantage at the expense of this thing. You want to shut down the rebellion in Syria, close that 60-mile, 100-kilometer stretch, starting at the Euphrates River, the town of Jarablus, and then going essentially west towards the Mediterranean from there. You close that, you have cut the aorta, you have cut the supply line, you have interdicted the food, the supplies, the gasoline, the spare parts, the recruits, the fanatics coming in, and you shut down the entire thing. We're getting constant reports of the horrendous problems for the refugees when they are on their way to Europe, when they are in Europe, the tremendous social conflicts and so forth unleashed by this. The better way is to pacify the situation in Syria from all kinds of terrorists, right? All of them. ISIS, al-Nusra, al-Qaeda, the Free Syrian Army, all terrorists. Anybody in the field with a Kalashnikov is a terrorist. Moderate opposition is in the Syrian parliament in Damascus. So the way to do it is to essentially cut the lifeline of all of these terrorist forces, and they all wither on the vine. And I demand that Russia and the United States do this now together. And I want to see that in the context of a continuing condominium. So we'll have to follow that. I think there is a lot of vagueness. I'm sorry to be so vague, but that's one of the characteristics of the deal. And remember, last week on this program, we had Thierry Meyssan saying there is a direct collaboration between the Kremlin and Putin and the White House and Obama. And that is opposed by the British, the French, the Israelis, and Turkey. And it's confirmed. There it is. Washington Post this morning. So listen to this program and you'll know what's happening at least 1 week in advance, in some cases much more. Now, concerning the financial situation, very briefly, there are rumblings in the derivatives market, right? We need to know, and I am announcing an attempt to develop a new estimate. I've been working with the estimate of $1.5 quadrillion in the derivatives universe. We are told little sort of, you know, fragments of data. The five biggest U.S. zombie banks have $280 trillion in derivatives. You've got all this stuff, right? Deutsche Bank has $100 trillion in derivatives. They have foolishly run ahead with that. We had on CNBC a guy the other day coming on and say, well, you know, in 2008, AIG in London had $3 trillion in credit default swaps, and that had to be propped up. That had to be bailed out, because otherwise that would have destroyed all the credit default swaps in the world, and every bank in the world would have gone down. And he said, in those days, $3 trillion in derivatives was a lot, says the guy on CNBC. But today, $3 trillion in derivatives is chicken feed. It's peanuts. So remember, I don't sit around trying to ponder when some market is going to blow. I try to impose the solution as fast as I can. And the solution is this: outlaw credit default swaps. If they're betting, that's illegal. If they're insurance, you haven't qualified as an insurance company, you don't have an insurable interest. Ban credit default swaps. And taking a book, leaf from the book of the great Lloyd Blankfein, when he was put before the Inquisition on Capitol Hill, the collateralized debt obligation must also be banned. Bright line, illegal, felony, jail time prohibitions. And then, to cool the entire situation, the 1% Wall Street sales tax imposed on all exchange-traded derivatives, that is to say, futures, options, indices, and the various combinations thereof, and on the designer or over-the-counter derivatives. So 1% tax on all buying and selling of all kinds of stocks, bonds, derivatives, over-the-counter, exchange, traded. Now, deflation continues to be a grave problem, and we're now told that more voices have been raised here in favor of not only a return to 0% credit by the Fed, but to negative rates. Here, what we would say is this: the Fed has got to be nationalized piece by piece, is probably the way to do it in terms of the political realities. We want a $1.5 trillion window to refinance all student debts at 0% and 100-year maturity. So we just forget about it. We want $5 trillion for a program of 30 million new productive jobs in infrastructure. And that gives us, what, a capital investment per job, or at least a fund, of about $170,000 per year per job. Bernie, with 13 million jobs coming out of a $1 trillion fund, is way down there at, you know, less than $70,000 per job. So we got to think about a bigger and better capital investment per job. So Bernie, you need to be less fuzzy and more detailed, and you should get it from us. And Yellen, you should get out of the way. You are a failure. You're a buckler. And now you see that hell is beginning to gape beneath your feet. So do what we say. Back next week on World Crisis Radio.